Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, letting people know about the pod. We really appreciate it. Really interesting show for you this week. We're going to be talking about sperm in space and a University of Adelaide researcher who's managed to create zero G to see whether or not sperm would do the job if we were on the moon or in Mars. Really interesting piece, and I learned a lot about sperm. If you want to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Professor Matthew Campbell of Trinity College Dublin. Our first story, Ruth, has to do with mosquitoes.
I know, it sounds like the beginning of a science fiction film. So big tech company is applying to the EPA in the USA to release 64 million modified mosquitoes. So the company in question is Google, and they're applying to release 32 million mosquitoes into Texas and 32 million into Florida. And this is building on a program that they've actually had for a while in their Google X, their Alphabet division, which kind of looks at projects for social good. And the thing that they're proposing to do is actually not that new, this idea of sterile insect technique. So it's a way of controlling insects that has been around for about 50 or 60 years. So the idea is that Google want to release male mosquitoes, but these mosquitoes have been infected with a bacteria called Wolbachia. And that means that when they mate with wild female mosquitoes, the eggs will be unviable. So over time, the population will go down. And they have had some experience of doing this in places like Singapore. But the reason they want to do this, of course, is because mosquitoes are the biggest killer on the planet when it comes to other animals apart from ourselves. You know, they kill hundreds of thousands of people every year because they're carriers of lots of different kinds of diseases, like dengue fever, yellow fever. And I guess with climate change, these things are all growing in prevalence in places like the US where they would have been relatively uncommon previously.
Why Google? What's Google got to do this?
Well, like I said, this project, they call it the Debug Program, and it began with their kind of life sciences division.
I bet the whole thing was sold on that
the
one
name,
title.
It's a good name. I guess this is part of their kind of social good.
Philanthropy.
Philanthropy. I mean, they've done this before, I suppose, with DeepMind. You know, it was there as a kind of project that they gave away publicly access to AI to solve protein structure. So it's this combination of trying to do things that are sort of open science with social good, obviously combined with their company activity as well. But they have done it before. They've done it in Singapore, where they saw a reduction in dengue cases by up to 70% in the whole area surrounding Singapore.
Has this ever been done in the United States before? Are there any risks associated with it? Because like the idea of, you know, releasing any sort of insects or animals into the wild that have been infected with something or had some sort of change is always a bit...
Yeah, it does. And I think that those conversations have definitely been brought up by this. So it was, I mean, back in the 1950s, the US government released, they got rid of a screw fly epidemic, which was another pest, an agricultural pest. And it has been used for things like tsetse flies and other agricultural pests. I mean, in many ways, it's more effective. I mean, the other alternative is using insecticides and chemical controls for these things, which obviously is much easier potentially to build up resistance to that because, you know, maybe a single gene mutation, a couple of mutations, you might end up with a resistant strain. Here, if you wipe out or drastically reduce the species, I mean, the questions to ask are, one, is it a critical part of the food chain for other species? And because the mosquito that they're targeting is an invasive species, it doesn't seem to be.
Yeah.
So in many ways, this is a species that shouldn't be there anyway. It hasn't evolved over hundreds of millions of years in these areas. But look, the concept that we can just go in and potentially wipe out another species probably, you know, has raised some interesting discussions also.
I'd say Trump is all for it. Our second story, Matthew, has to do with cancer. And actually, there's a couple of interesting stories out this week, and I was wondering why, but there is a reason.
Yeah, so this week, every year sees that the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the ASCO meeting, is held every year, and this year it's all in Chicago. And what we're seeing this week is the announcement of clinical trial data, basically, where scientists and medical doctors have been studying the effect of new drugs for treating a whole range of cancers. And some of the results are actually incredibly exciting. The first story kind of revolves around this, what they call a smart drug. And it's a combination immunotherapy. So basically, people will have heard of immunotherapies. So basically drugs that are used in cancer patients to direct the person's immune system to identify the cancer cells and kill them and get rid of them. And they're incredibly effective. But for some patients, they don't respond to them. Mm. So the reason they don't respond is that some cancer cells and tumors can produce an enzyme that basically creates this invisibility cloak around the tumors, and it doesn't allow the immunotherapy to actually detect and kill the cancer cell.
Yeah.
So what this smart drug basically that was developed in Oxford, what it's done basically is it's designed to suppress the enzyme that creates that invisibility cloak. So it's a combination of immunotherapy and a drug with the very exciting name of GRWD5769. Mm-hmm. So it's basically the concept of the smart drug. It was a small trial, phase one clinical trial. They were just looking for safety. So in phase one clinical trials, you just look for safety, but they actually got efficacy. Out of 83 patients with a whole range of different cancers, cervical cancer, bladder cancer, liver cancer, out of 83 patients, 15 of those patients saw their tumor shrink by up to 30%. So these are really, really exciting results for what is essentially a novel form of therapy, but a combination therapy. So offering real hope to those patients that aren't responding to immunotherapy.
And then there was another one about cancer jab.
The second story was actually even more exciting because it was a more advanced clinical trial. So it's moving beyond the phase one trials where you're looking just for safety. You're now looking for efficacy. And it was larger. So this drug, it's called amivantamab. It's being developed by the large pharmaceutical company, Johnson & Johnson. And there are over 90 different trials going on worldwide. So this shows you what can happen when you get a large pharma company with huge, deep pockets throwing their weight behind developing novel drugs for cancer. The most amazing thing about this drug is that it's a subcutaneous injection. So for chemotherapy, patients have to go in to get drugs infused into a vein. Very, very timely. It takes a long time for that to happen. So this is a subcutaneous drug. And basically, it's an antibody. It's what we term a bispecific. So it targets two parts of how cancer is spread. It targets a protein called EGFR, which is what cancer uses to grow, instructions used to grow. And the second thing it blocks is MET. And what MET basically does, it's the same concept. It's used to silence the cells so the immune system can't detect it. So the results in this have been really startling. So the trial involved 102 patients across 11 countries, so quite a large trial. In 15 patients, they saw their tumours completely disappear altogether.
My God.
And the most amazing thing, what we look for in these trials is, you know, progress-free survival and overall survival. But one of the main things that came through from this announcement from Johnson & Johnson was real-world lived experience, what patients are saying. So just to quote one of the guys who was involved in the study, a man named Carl Walsh, 56-year-old man who had tongue cancer, wasn't responding to therapy, but he was now responding to this therapy. And he said, "I now feel able to live a normal life. Before starting the trial, I struggled to speak properly and found eating difficult because of the swelling and pain. The thing I enjoyed most now was the first big steak." Hmm. So, you know, the concept now is that you put life in your years, not years in your life.
Fantastic. Yeah. Our third story, Ruth, is about an underwater find and quite an exciting one.
It is. And it's a find that comes, it was announced, it's not in a peer-reviewed journal, but it's been announced from the New Providence Pirates Expedition. And it was also published in something called Wreck Watch magazine. And that magazine is edited by the co-director here, Dr. Sean Kingsley. And this is an expedition that happened in the Bahamas, in Nassau in the Bahamas. And what's interesting about this, it is the first real archaeological evidence of the pirates in the Caribbean. Hmm. So we all know about the Pirates of the Caribbean from the movies. And the Bahamas was seen to be the centre of kind of pirate republic between about 1690 and 1720. But we know all this from written records. So things like governors from the colonies writing back, talking about all these pirates. And, you know, we're talking about people like Blackbeard, you know, really, really famous pirates. But up until now, there has been no actual archaeological evidence. And you might think, well, the Bahamas, that sounds like a lovely place to go and look for things on the bottom of the ocean. But in fact, it's an incredibly challenging place to go and dive. So there's been a huge amount of dredging on the seafloor. So again, anything that's there has been broken up and churned up. There's very dangerous tides, so it can be quite challenging. And the area where these wrecks were located, there's also an awful lot of bull sharks. So the researchers talked about having to go down using tools that would potentially attract sharks, making vibrations and sort of just going into a zen state as they examine timbers, trying not to think about the bull sharks potentially circling. So it was real Indiana Jones stuff. But what they found, the remains of six different ships. They found cannons, musket balls, tobacco pipes, and something
Any
called
parrots.
No parrots, but they found something called a swivel gun. And this is really interesting because a swivel gun is not like the massive cannon that you see that puts a big hole in the boat, which sinks it. Because, of course, if you're trying to take a boat, you want to keep everything on board and you want to take all the gold and the loot that's on it before it sinks. But these swivel guns were much lighter cannons that enabled, in the records, the pirates would shoot them at the deck. You know, they would obviously injure the people on board, but then they would go on and board the ship. And the other really interesting thing that they found was one of the ships was burnt. But it was badly burnt to the waterline. And the analogy here is kind of the getaway car, because if a pirate did capture a ship, they would clean it out of all its goods. But if you were sailing around in this ship, you were essentially, you know, advertising that you had taken it. Yeah. And the sentence was death. So once everything had been stripped off the ship, they would burn it. And once the burning got to the waterline, the ship would lose its buoyancy and its integrity, and it would sink. And in fact, the thing that historians are really excited about is there was a very famous pirate called Henry Avery. They say if Blackbeard was the most famous, Henry Avery was the most successful. He pulled off one of the biggest heights. He captured an Indian treasure ship, which was worth hundreds and hundreds of millions in today's terms. But the idea was his ship, the Fancy, was eventually burnt and sunk. And the story is that it was somewhere around NASA around this time. So really exciting archaeological evidence, bringing a lot of what we have in written history and folklore to life.
Fantastic. Our final story, Matthew, has to do with autism.
Yes. So this study was really interesting, in fact, because it kind of highlights and suggests that maybe there's two types of autism. But before I start, maybe I'll just highlight what doesn't cause autism. So vaccines don't cause autism. Tylenol, or as we more commonly refer to it as paracetamol in Ireland, doesn't cause autism. Parenting style, screen time doesn't cause autism. Believe it or not, autism is one of the most heritable types of conditions that we know of. So there's a very, very strong genetic composition to this. And we know this from twin studies, identical twin studies. If an identical twin has autism, there's a 90% chance basically that the other identical twin will have it. Because remember, they're genetically identical to each other. Now, what this study did was it used brain scans of over 1,000 children and young adults who were diagnosed by psychiatrists as having autism. And they suggest that maybe there's two different types of autism that are based on the connectivity of brain cells. So basically, some people who have autism have hyperconnectivity, where the brain cells are communicating with each other way too much. There are other people that they're suggesting have hypoconnectivity, which is the opposite, where the connections are reduced, basically. So it's a really, really compelling concept that there's maybe at the biological level, there are two different types of autism. What they also did was they cross-referenced it to different species. So as well as doing this very, very large human study, they went and looked at the brains of 20 mice, so mouse models of autism. The luxury we have preclinically is that you can develop animal models of conditions. So they looked
at autism?
Of autism,
but
yeah.
How, when I know, having spoken about autism on the program before, it's not fully genetic. There are environmental factors as
yeah,
well.
So, like,
how do you know if a mouse has autism?
Believe it or not, there are ways to predict. So there's a thing called the marble burying technique. So basically, animals that show signs of autistic and compulsive behavior, well, you put marbles into the cage and they'll obsessively bury the marbles compulsively. So that's just one example of loads of different tools that we have at the behavioral level to figure out, are there autistic-like traits in animals? Huh. So we do have animal models of autism-like, what we term phenotypes. But what this group did was they went to 20 different models of disease and they saw the same thing, that in these animal models, they were able to stratify them based on hypo or hyperconnectivity of their brain cells.
So in these two subgroups, was there any sort of correlation with the condition? Because, you know, when we think of the autistic spectrum, it seems to the layperson so wide that you would have someone who is fully able to function in society, you know, even outperform, you know, neurotypical people on tasks like mathematics and so on, and function very well. And then you have other people who are diagnosed supposedly with the same condition and yet can't speak or need care 24/7. I remember this phrase that Sacha Baron Cohen's brother, who's a researcher in autism, told me. He said, if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. And I thought that was really interesting.
That's right. No, I mean, what's happening? So basically, as the tools that we're using to piece apart how biology is working, they're getting better. And I suppose maybe the diagnostic criteria are getting wider as well for autistic-like behaviors. So I think both things are moving at different paces. So I think our tools for looking at the biological paradigm is moving quicker than the rates of being able to understand fully what autism is at the human level. Certainly, we do know that there are increased rates of likely because the spectrum is getting bigger as we understand it better. But there's loads and loads of different variables. You're exactly right that, that environmental cues, we know that parental age, especially male parental age, there's a higher predisposition to have children with autism. But really, it has to come back to the genetics, because that's a really, really, what I started with talking about, that it's 90% heritable. That's incredibly high for a condition. So basically, what we tend to see with people who are diagnosed with autism, in all likelihood, one of the parents will likely be diagnosed with the same type of autism.
That's
when you compare it to neurotypical. You know, because it's difficult to use the terminology of a disease. Is it a disease? Or it's a neurodiversity compared to neurotypical brain. So it's, challenging to understand. But I think this is the first clue that there may be biological rationale to explain both of them based on hyper and hypoconnectivity.
Right. Really interesting. Professor Matthew Campbell of Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland. Thank you very much. Now, every animal on this planet is uniquely adapted to the specific environment that they evolved in. A constant in all those environments is gravity. So naturally, when that gravity is removed, there is necessarily some disorientation. Any astronaut can tell you that. But does disorientation extend to our sperm? That is the question our next guest is trying to answer. Hannah Lyons is a reproduction researcher in Adelaide University. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Hannah. This is quite an interesting one because, of course, the future and the distant future, I suppose we have to say, does involve potentially colonizing other planets, colonizing the moon, working at long periods. And of course, understanding how sperm works has a relevance to that across a number of different factors, right?
Yeah, of course. So I guess we were interested in this project, like you said, because there's talk about colonizing other planets. And reproduction is going to be critical for that. So whether that's from the perspective of our livestock, food management and waste management perspective, or whether that's actually from human reproduction occurring, it all starts with a sperm and an egg. And we were really interested in understanding if in space-like environments, especially zero gravity, like you might experience on a spaceship, whether or not sperm would be able to achieve fertilization for an embryo to develop.
Have we reproduced any species in space yet, do you know?
So not from complete start to finish. So they've sent up already pre-fertilized embryos that were made here on Earth and sent them up into the International Space Station and allowed them to develop. And then they've transplanted those embryos into live animals back here on Earth.
Wow.
To create babies, but they haven't obviously recreated babies at the ISS, and they haven't achieved fertilization in the ISS.
Right. Okay. Just as an aside, before we talk about your research, did those fertilized eggs develop into healthy animals?
Yes, I believe they had live mouse births from some of those embryos. Yeah.
Okay, that's really cool. So, so your work is looking at human sperm. Is that right?
I looked at human sperm, mouse sperm, and pig sperm.
All right. Okay. Why those three? Just out of interest.
So mouse sperm, it's a easy model that we're already used to working with that's quite easily accessible. Humans, because obviously we wanted to know if humans could reproduce, and pigs, again, from a livestock perspective and a large domesticated animal.
Right. And so how do you go about designing an experiment to mimic zero G in space and look at something as dynamic and as motile as sperm?
Yeah, so that was the first major hurdle of the study. So we partnered with a biotech company here in South Australia who had developed what's called a dual access 3D clinostat. So basically it allows us to put small plates on this machine and it be constantly rotating to disperse the forces of gravity. So at no one point is it feeling gravity in any one direction. So that gave us our zero G microgravity environment.
Like just kind of randomly spinning around in all sorts of different directions.
Yeah.
And that's the best analogy we can have to zero G at the moment, is it?
Yes. Yeah. Outside of creating like a vacuum chamber and things like that.
Right. And just out of interest, why not a vacuum chamber?
Well, you'd just immediately kill your cells.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I've forgotten about that part. Yeah, exactly. In space, no one can hear you scream.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, so we had access to this machine, which beautifully fit in our culturing incubator. And then we were able to, we had to find a system which would allow us to make a closed loop where there was no air in the system. It was completely filled with liquid, which gave us our culturing environment that we were then able to add sperm into the plug at one end and collect at the other end when we were plugging the device.
And this is sperm that you have, you've gotten from pig, mouse and human sperm. And the idea is that you put them in, you can't surely visualize what's going on there. You can't scan what's happening with the sperm as it's being flung around by, what's the name of this machine that?
It's a 3D clinostat.
A clinostat. Is that a new type of machine? Has it been around for a while?
No, it's been around for a while.
Okay. Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't allow live scanning or anything of this sperm, does it?
Not at the moment. So we are working with a group of engineers who make microfluidic devices, and they're talking about being able to put a very small camera into their microfluidic device, which we could then put onto this microgravity machine and potentially be able to live watch either the embryos or the sperm. But at the moment, we can only obviously put it in there and assess afterwards.
Okay, so we have the sperm flinging around in zero gravity. You put some sperm in, there's an out point. What is the design of the experiment? Is it just can the sperm get from A to B? Can the sperm survive? What are the things you're trying to explore?
Yeah, so the first iteration of the experiments was just knowing, can the sperm survive? Will they still be able to swim to any capacity? And can they get from A to B? So they were challenged along a channel slide. So we put them in one end, collected the other end. And yeah, so first and foremost, that's what we looked at. We've got a semen analysis machine at the university, and we were able to test these sperm before they went in the machine, once they'd gone in the machine, and then we had a normal gravity control that we ran alongside.
Oh, okay. So you have a normal version to know what this sperm should look like in normal gravity, and then what the zero G sperm looked like. And so what sort of changes before you'd done the experiment did you expect?
So we were expecting to see changes in most parameters, to be honest. We were expecting to see a decline in their ability to swim. We thought we'd see a drop in motility potentially, a drop in potentially their vitality, that they would actually just die not having any gravity, that they wouldn't be very happy. And we did expect that we wouldn't find as many sperm able to navigate the channel than we would at normal gravity.
So describe this navigating the channel. This is the way a sperm would find its way through the fallopian tube to the egg, right?
Yeah. So sperm like to swim close to surfaces. So when you've got like a channel slide, they will try to, their best swimming will be done at the outer edges of the channel, and it helps them to navigate to the other end, similar to the way that the female reproductive tract works.
I thought it was like a sort of one of those mechanical things where you twist at the back and it just goes. You're telling me the sperm changes how much it swims based on what sort of cues from the lining of the womb or what?
Yeah. They have different modes of swimming, sperm do. So depending on where they sit within a fluid, they'll swim slightly differently. Depending on how close they are to another surface, they can change their tail patterns. Being closer to the edge, they can sense the barrier and they like to swim along it. And they also like to swim against the flow of fluid.
How does the sperm know to do that, it being a very simple cell?
Yeah, they're probably not as simple as everyone thinks that they are. They carry a really large repertoire of receptors and sensors that allow them to sense temperature, chemical signatures, force and pressure.
Wow.
Yeah, lots of things, really.
And so all of these sort of cues through evolution, all of these cues tell the sperm when to swim like mad and when to go slowly, what to do in different environments and under different pressures and temperatures.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So as you go up the female reproductive tract, you get slight increases in the temperature, and that helps them to know which direction to be going in. The egg is constantly releasing factors that attract the sperm to them, again, helping them know where to swim. Same with the flow of the mucus and the fluid within the reproductive tract, they know to swim against it. So wherever the fluid is moving a bit faster, the swim know, okay, that's the way I need to swim and I'll swim through that. So yeah, they're very, there's all these wonderful evolutionary mechanisms to get the sperm where they need to go.
That's incredible. So what did you find when you, so you made a little bit of an obstacle course to sort of make something that you thought would be a basic analog for this journey that the sperm makes? Is that the idea? How did they perform?
Yeah, so we had a basic channel in this set of experiments. In the future, we want to even further recapitulate the female reproductive tract. But yeah, so they had to swim from A to B down this channel. And what we found was that some sperm could swim from A to B, but there was a lot less sperm that were able to navigate in that zero G environment.
How much less?
Oh, about 50% less.
Okay.
So a large reduction, but what we did find was those sperm that could navigate were perfectly fine. Otherwise they had normal motility and all the other parameters were completely normal to what we saw in the normal gravity. It was just that there was less of them. And interestingly, we thought, what could be the purpose for this? And we actually found that in the human sperm, those sperm that got to the end of the channel could better bind a surrogate measure of binding to an egg, which is called like a HBA assay. And then moving on to the mouse and the pig, we wanted to test this again. And we actually found that these sperm that could navigate the channel could fertilize, and that the embryos that they made were of higher quality, which was really surprising for us. So it was sort of acting like a selective pressure for the sperm and selecting out better quality. So less were able to get through at zero G, but the ones that could do so because they were a better quality sperm.
Right. So this this concept of survival of the fittest continues even in zero gravity.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very cool. So the sperm that did make it were healthier and presumably would have provided, because they had to go through that little bit of extra struggle to sort of wean out the weaker ones, they would provide, they probably provide healthier offspring generally in any species as far as we can see.
Yeah. So what we saw was that those embryos that we made from these sperm, they had more cells allocated towards the fetal development side of the embryo. So and that's generally a marker that, yeah, these are going to make better embryos and better offspring if you were then to put those embryos back into the animal.
Okay. If we, with those sort of numbers, would that make it very difficult to reproduce in zero G?
So this is obviously, this experimental design was done in a very short time frame. So the original sperm measures were done after an hour, and then the embryo measures were done after 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
So that exposure time is very short comparative to when you think about actual reproduction. The sperm are traveling through the tract for 12 to 24 hours. The human would be exposed for a lot longer time than that. Pregnancy is obviously a lot longer. So you can't really extrapolate it out to whether or not we'd be able to reproduce. Even when we did the experiments for more like 24 hours, we saw any of those positive effects were negated by the negative effects, presumably on the embryo being at zero G. So yeah, so at the moment, it doesn't look likely that that would mean necessarily that we would be able to reproduce, but it does mean that at least the sperm do have motility and they are able to fertilize still at that zero G. And perhaps what we've learned from this study, we can apply here on Earth to look at ways to select the best sperm.
In what way? How would you do that?
So commonly in assisted reproductive technology systems, we select sperm for IVF or for ICSI, where we inject the sperm directly into the egg. And we're constantly looking for new methods to pick out what the best sperm possibly is. So people have made microfluidic devices and all sorts. And whilst we might not use this particular device, say in an IVF setting, if we can find out what the molecular fingerprint of these better, higher quality sperm are, we can potentially develop technology that can select for them.
Right.
In an IVF
setting.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, you might find something that's common amongst these sperm that did very well in a zero G experiment, and that might help us pick better candidates for IVF. Very cool. What about actually on the moon or on a planet that might have more gravity, the moon obviously having a lot less, but other planets having a lot more. Do we know anything about how that would affect sperm motility and its ability to reach an egg?
Yeah, so again, that's sort of what we're interested in looking at in the future, because we are curious as to whether this is a bit of a dose-dependent effect of, is there a level of gravity that is enough to still be able to reproduce? Like Mars is a bit more like 60% close to similar to Earth's gravity, and obviously the moon's a bit less than that. But whether or not there is a dose that we can get reproduction, and whether or not if stimulated gravity can reach those levels, if we might still be able to reproduce in space, as opposed to the extreme that we've looked at, which is Earth's gravity versus essentially no gravity.
Mm. I have it on relatively good information that sex has already happened in space. I'm not going to tell you how or why I know this. I'm just wondering, have you also heard this story?
Well, yes. It's the most common question that we get is, oh, yeah, when they've done it, what could have happened?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think any children have come out of any time gaps there, but I don't want to cast aspersions, because it is an unconfirmed rumor that I heard from an astronaut. But so far we feel that reproduction, at least where we're not using a fertilized embryo, that actually, you know, natural insemination is going to be difficult. So breeding animals on the moon, breeding animals on any other planet, very difficult in a natural way. Although it's difficult to imagine that is how we would be relying on getting offspring in space, given you know, the ease of making fertilized embryo.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interest of companies and researchers around. I think a lot of where the field thinks it might go is potentially in artificial womb technology, where humans might not be able, and animals might not be able to carry pregnancies themselves, but we might be able to make an artificial womb that is a bit more robust and less affected by the mechanical forces that go alongside space travel. And those might be able to help us reproduce, whether that's, yeah, like I said, livestock or humans. But at the moment, there's a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of barriers between where we are currently and reproducing in space.
It is. It's pretty niche. And the applications of this sort of research, you know, hopefully will help IVF. But in terms of actually having reproduction in space, it seems very far off that we need to sort of actually practically answer this question. Is there a lot of interest and money in this? Are people investing, you know, in companies? Is there capital being moved around trying to solve this problem? Or is it purely a research question at the moment?
There's definitely some startup companies that are looking into this. I believe there's one called Spaceborn, which is looking at similar things to what we have, which is making devices where they can test for fertilization and things like that in zero G and potentially space environments. There's groups out of Japan that have done the work where they've sent up embryos and sperm and up with the ISS. But outside of groups that already have access to things like a space agency, at my university, we've got a Center for Space Research. Outside of those sort of niche interest areas, there's not a lot of money and there's not a lot of active research happening in this space.
Yeah. Very interesting stuff though. I mean, like this is like, I'm sure at dinner parties, people are fascinated by your work.
Yeah.
But Hannah Lyons is a reproduction researcher in Adelaide University. Hannah, thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
There you go. I learned a lot there. I hope you did too. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, Hugo De Silva Scotland sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Tuesday in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.